This is Cheryl McQuaid. I'm with the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. We're preparing to interview Diane Archer. It is November 10th, 2005, approximately 10 a.m. We're in the Labor Relations Conference Room at Fisher Body. First of all, we're going to state everybody's name so that we have that for the record.
Doreen Howard.
Diane.
Lynn Johnson.
Doug Rademacher.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fedewa.
And Diane, could you state your name, spell your last name for us?
Diane Archer, A-R-C-H-E-R.
And what's your address, Diane?
456 South Rosemary, Lansing, Michigan, 48917.
And are you married? Do you have children?
I'm divorced. I have two children, a 25-year-old daughter and a 26-year-old son.
And have you ever done any military service?
No, ma'am.
Could you give us a little bit about your educational background?
I graduated from high school in Flint, Burton, from Atherton High School in 1976, and I attended Mott College in Flint until for 4 years, part-time.
And what is your hire-in date at Fisher Body, and why did you come here?
I hired into Fisher Body in August of 1983 as I was laid off from Chevrolet.
Okay, so was that like a GM Gypsy? Did they move you here, or was that a whole new hiring?
Doug Rademacher. Diane, how did you find out about Fisher Body hiring, and did you put in for it, or did they send you here by?
I was laid off from Chevrolet, and I went back to get my toolbox 3 days later, and it had to be cleared through personnel. And when I went into personnel, Bob McMonagle from Lansing was there to hire pipe fitters. And he happened to be in the office I walked into when he said Lansing was looking for pipe fitters. So I was told to report to work the next day in Lansing.
Oh, wow.
So it was coincidental, but.
Linda Johnson, were you relieved? Were you happy? Were you saying, oh, I got to move to Lansing? Or, I mean, how did you feel about having to switch places of employment?
I was excited that I had a job. Because I had been laid off once previously when the subfund went dry. So I had no money from before, and now that I was back to work at Chevrolet when they laid me off the second time, I was a nervous wreck. But when I found out from McMonagle Lansing was hired, I was excited. I was scared because I never had been in any other GM facility before, you know, so I was scared of meeting all new people and that, but I was glad I had a job.
Doreen Howard.
You talked about the Chevrolet plant. When did you first hire into Chevrolet?
I hired into Chevrolet May 12th, 1977.
And that's the first plant and facility that you worked at for General Motors?
Yeah, for General Motors. That was the first plant. I had completed a pre-apprenticeship program through Mott Community College. So I made application, and I got hired on the production line first.
And then you said you were laid off from there, and that's when you came here? But you talked about another.
I got laid off back around 1981.
From the Chevrolet, and then you were recalled back to that facility?
I was laid off for approximately 6 months, and then I was called back to Chevrolet Manufacturing again.
And at Chevy Manufacturing, you hired in hourly on the line and then went into this trade?
Yeah. And yes, into the pipe fitter apprenticeship.
Marilyn Coulter.
And now you said that you were the first female pipe fitter there?
At Chevrolet Manufacturing.
What was that like to be the first female? What did you go through being the first female pipe fitter, please?
It was difficult. I had six brothers. So I was used to being picked on as a girl. But we did not have sexual laws against sexual discrimination or harassment back then. So I'll be honest, it was very difficult. I mean, the first day, the supervisor took me to two other pipe fitters as an apprentice and said, you'll be working with these two guys, Grin and Barrett. Do you understand what I mean? So, yeah, it was difficult back in the 70s, being a female. I was reminded that it was, you know, a non-traditional work almost daily for women. But I did carry my share of the load. You know, I was raised with six brothers. My father forgot there was that line there, you know, when he raised us. So, I mean, I tolerated, and women can do it and be successful. But you have to prove yourself. You're constantly proving yourself. Even when I came to Lansing, I came down as a journeyman pipe fitter, and you had to prove yourself again to the male pipe fitters. I applied to go on supervision, and the first thing they told me in personnel here was, well, first you have to get a journeyman's card to be a maintenance supervisor, and we don't have female journeymen in Lansing in the pipe fitters. And then I had to explain I came down as a journeyman pipe fitter. So, yeah, it was a struggle.
When did you notice the biggest change for women?
I think that really started changing for women around the 90s, maybe as late as 95. It's been very recent as far as I'm concerned for women.
Doreen Howard.
Were you the first woman here in our facility as a pipe fitter?
The first journeyman. We had two female apprentices when I came down here. They were in their third and fourth periods. So that's why in the office and personnel, they didn't know they had female journeyman pipe fitters. There was two of us down here. Another girl, Kathy, who also came from Flint the same week I came down. She has since returned to Flint. She was here a couple months and went back.
And journeyman means that you've already gone through all of your training and you're a full-fledged pipe fitter?
Right.
Is that what that
means? You've gone through the apprenticeship, yep.
Okay. So there was you and another woman that were already journeymen, and then there was two that were in training? Is that correct?
Yeah, there was two here going through their apprenticeship. Okay. And then two of us came down, Kathy and myself. She hired on second at Chevrolet. She was behind me in the apprenticeship program. But she actually came down here the week before I did because she had found out it wasn't like they took us in the pecking order, you know. Yes.
Doug Rademacher. Diane, would you tell us about your first day coming into Lansing Fisher Body, and also, did the apprentices, the female apprentices, did they appreciate you, or were you a threat to their advancement? How was that perceived? Could you share your first day and a little bit about that?
I think the females were very excited, you know, because power does come in numbers. So the larger your group gets, the easier it is. It lessens the power to prove. And so, yeah, they were happy. I mean, they were the first two to introduce themselves to me. Hi, I'm Beth, and I'm Lou Ann. They were awed that Chevrolet had put on apprentices so many years prior to Fisher Body putting on the apprentices. But they did have some EITs in small tools when I came here. And Beth and Marlene, and the same, they come down. All the women come over to meet you first. And the men, some accepted that you were here. And that was not, toward the men, I didn't feel any animosity gender-related when I first came here. We were outsiders. We had come from a different facility. So we were. And you look at both sides. I mean, I looked at both sides. Most of them wanted their children employed here, and when outsiders are transferred here from other facilities, it knocks out their chances to getting their family or friends employed. So that wasn't anything gender that I felt from the men when I come down here. It was more I was taking a job that they wanted someone else to have.
Diane, you said EIT. What is EIT?
An EIT is an employee in training that takes 8 years versus 4 years through an apprenticeship.
Maryland culture.
Diane, because you came from two different cultures, not only from cities and plants, what was the biggest difference that you noticed between Lansing plant and the Flint plant as far as people?
The biggest culture as far as people. And it took me a while because myself, I was abusive in that area. Working at Chevrolet, you were right down in the hole, right downtown, okay, in a very diversified group, and everyone drove into the city to work. So the expression up there is he's acting like a farmer. When I came to Lansing, I didn't realize most everyone working here was from a farm community. And so the expression came with me, you know, when someone was doing something different, I'd say, oh, he's acting like a farmer, to find out that was their other business, farming. So it's like I brought on a couple problems myself because of the expression. Boy, they're a farmer, or they come in off the haystack, the hay wagon, you know. And in Lansing, because it's spread out, you know, it's not in the city or downtown. It's the difference between Hicksville and downtown. But I could say him. He's acting like a farmer.
Because he knew he was.
Yeah, and the first one was Paulie, you know, Paul Urich. And he's a great, wonderful guy. But I say, man, he acts like a farmer, and he is. He only farms 3,000 acres. Yeah, that was the hardest cultural shock for me because I never knew a farm. My daughter was 9 years old before she ever seen a chicken, you know? So it was like, it's different.
And were the facilities run primarily the same, being both under the General Motors umbrella?
Yes. At that time, back in the early 80s, you know, hourly didn't go into the office, and management stayed in the office, unless they had a reason to come out of the office. And it was that way I seen, through my eyes, at both Chevrolet and down here.
Was that the same for 659 and 602 UAWs also?
As far as I could tell, I didn't really see any difference in the union representation up there versus down here. You know, that was very similar. But I was pro-union up there and went management down here. But that was not because of the difference in the locals. That was because, which the union has changed today. When I came down here, I already had 7.5 years with the corporation, and when I hired into Lansing, I had to start over again as day one for pick and shift, vacations, you know, and the company assigned me to work down here. I didn't qualify for unemployment if I didn't come, so I didn't have a choice but to report. Then they made me sign a document that I would stay at least 1 year without returning. So I'm forced to be here. And then they had hired two pipe fitters off the street the day before my arrival, and they get to pick a shift in an area before I do. See, and I was upset with that. And so I did go management because they count all of your GM seniority. And therefore, I could raise my children being a single parent. They were 2 and 3 when I came down here. I could work third shift and day shift and then raise them all afternoon. I was home with them when they come home from school, and I was there when I put them to bed at night by working midnights, which I couldn't do had I stayed on the floor as a pipe fitter. So therefore, I went into management to accommodate my life, my personal life. And now it's changed with, you know, with the union where they take their seniority of the 85. Within a few years, it'll be corporate. But it does. It really hurts you when you think, wait, I have 7.5 years with this company, and that guy has a day, and he gets to pick his shift over me. Mm-hmm. When it wasn't Diane Archer saying, hey, I want to go live in Lansing. I want to move 75 miles away from everybody I know. Yeah, and now I want to work a shift where I can never see my children because this guy has 1 day on me. So, but I do like that the union has that now for all their hourly. because I don't know if I'd have went on management had I been able to stay on days or third and raise my children.
What was the time frame, Doreen Howard, what was the time frame for the transition from the hourly to the management? How long were you here before you went into
management? I come down here August of 83, applied for management in December, and started a pre-supervisory trainer in January and went on as a permanent supervisor in May. So it was about 10 months.
So can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a supervisor for skilled trades?
It's wonderful.
It's
the best job in the world. Yeah. I have great benefits. I have a great crew. I like my job.
So
it's,
what department,
job.
What department does your crew work out of?
Right. Well, with Delta, I will be in GA, General Assembly. But I've spent, up until May of this year, I spent 17 years in the body shop with maintenance. So it's different for me right now than the last 17 years.
And what shift did you spend most of that time on?
I spent 16 of the 17 years on third shift.
Oh, really?
So, Maricopa, being over maintenance in the body shop with all the automation there, that's down there, did that make it, I'm sure it was exciting. What was that like? Because there's so many machines and things down there. You had to work on those? Is that what your crew did?
Yeah, my crew maintained and PM'd. So you work on uptime and you work on the problems. If the machinery breaks down, you go out and get it running again. And you maintain the equipment through PM to make sure it doesn't break down. The goal is no breakdowns.
And PM is?
Preventative maintenance, my apologies. Like on your car, you know, at home you change the oil, check the air pressure on your tires. That. Well, we do this to machineries, checking the oil, the contaminants, looking at the gears, listening for the different sounds, making sure everything's up to level, doing predictive, where we do vibration analysis. And the new thing is infrared, where they can actually shoot the equipment and see what's heating up. So, yeah,
when,
that helps.
When you first came here, how many robots were in the body shop at that time compared to how many are there as of in May?
We had robots at Chevrolet back in the 70s. However, when I came to Lansing, I don't think they had any robots. The excitement was they were getting some for the 1984 model changeover for the GM20. And so they started installing robots here. And that's where it really helped, having some of the Flint workforce, because our electricians were used to programming robots, and no one down here had been working on robots. The biggest difference there in robots is up there we named them, and then down here they said that's too personal and that people would get too comfortable around them. So they didn't allow us to name them in Lansing. But we had cells, Larry Moe and Curly and George and Julie, and you just called them like a name up there. Where here we gave them station numbers. And you said station ADL2. You didn't say go see Joe. But yeah, up there we had probably 50 robots at Chevrolet, and we come down here to zero. And when we closed, we had 783 robots. And I heard Delta will be more. Yeah. Yeah. But it's like people on the line. Pretty soon you know all their names.
Doreen Howard.
So how did that change your job and your crew's jobs, going from very few to that many robots toward the end?
Well, they brought them in slow in the beginning, you know, robots here and there. And then by the last changeover, it was like, well, going to LDT. Now it's just loaded with robots. But the gradual change, you have a right to, or the ability to train the electricians. And that's the greatest thing about my job now. I mean, I have to tell you this, not with the interview, but all this training we're doing for Delta is wonderful. You know, because even though we're getting a different style robot and we're getting new equipment that we've never seen before, they're allowing the skilled trades to go to the BIOS, you know, to go to deep dives to see what they see wrong with the equipment or what could make it better right off the bat, and training them.
So, Marilyn Coulter.
So as far as the cultural change and things like that, initially, years ago, there wasn't much employee involvement in those types of decisions?
There was no employee involvement. I mean, none. In fact, when I came here as a pipe fitter in 83, at Chevrolet, pipe fitters did not rebuild cylinders. And when I came here, the second day I had a cylinder break, so I went to take it to machine repair, and Lansing pipe fitters rebuilt cylinders. So when I told the boss, I don't know, I never had to rebuild a cylinder before. He told me that was part of my job, to learn how to do it and to find someone to show me. I mean, that point blank, that's your job, figure out how to do it or find somebody to show you. And he went back in the office. So I did that. I mean, I went out with another pipe fitter who showed me how to do it. But now the training's right there. It's right there. All of it you can handle.
But, and for the people who don't think, can you explain deep dive a little bit, the term deep dive?
A deep dive is a chance before the equipment is set into location. We actually go out to the vendor, and you look at the equipment. You make sure that all the gauges are, that maintenance-wise, you can maintain that equipment. Where previously, they could put the gauge wherever they wanted, just have it on the equipment. Now, we go and look at every little detail we can. We're staying constant as far as if you're using MAC valves, put MAC valves on everything. If you're using a certain quarter turn, it's a quarter turn on the same brand. And at a deep dive, if you notice that they're using something unique or odd, that's your chance to tell them before we buy the equipment that, you know, that's not up to our code. That's not what we're using here. And they change it. And they'll have a punch list. The last one I've seen from one deep dive had 59 problems that our hourly guys pointed out. 59 problems that they will change before it's bought off, before General Motors accepts it. Because their problems, not that we've changed our mind, we prefer a different, they were written in the specs, you know, that they will meet our codes. And they're not. The gauges isn't facing out or...
So that also helps you not only in being able to maintain that equipment, but it also helps in the safety of yourself and your employees, yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And safety, we have really progressed in safety. I got to tell you that. It's unbelievable.
Doug Rademacher.
Diane, will you tell us about supervisor techniques and also talk about changeovers and what it's like to be a trades supervisor during a changeover?
The major changeovers or...
Well, the 2 weeks or something where you have the mandatory shutdown time where I believe you load things into a time frame.
Yeah. During, as a maintenance supervisor, on the past 2 week changeovers, we have grouped together, mind you, with very little input from the hourly, and decided what work had to be done. We will ask our crew, but they didn't sit in those meetings. And put together a work list, order all the materials we needed because we knew we just had the 2 weeks to change anything wanted or added in. On the bigger changeovers, they're much more difficult. Like this move to Delta, it's a very difficult move. Installing what we're, like the part we're doing, which I was out on last week, installing water test booths. You know, it has the prints, and we had a plan. However, when it gets into location, we found out that the wiring wasn't, they didn't do it to code, so now we got to change the conduit from 2 to 4, but it hasn't been installed. And we try to do that in advance for every changeover I've ever been involved in, have the materials here, a plan, a job plan. And it's exciting. It really is. It's like remodeling a room in your house. That's why I love maintenance. So that's changeover. We look forward to it as maintenance people. It's your great opportunity.
Linda Johnson.
Diane, you seem and have, since this interview started, really excited about what you do. And as a young woman, what made you choose while you were in college that you wanted to be in the skilled trades arena?
General Motors is the best employer in the world. I tell everybody that. We have wonderful benefits, salary, hourly alike. We have great job security, salary and hourly alike. So I wanted to hire into General Motors. My father worked there. My grandfather worked there. I'm actually fourth generation GM employee. They're all deceased now, but it provided for me as a child. It's provided well for my children. So I appreciate that. I appreciate the company. And my job is exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, I decided if I ever got into GM, which I have done, that I wouldn't stay on that line forever because I wanted to see everything I could see within GM. You know, so it's exciting moving around. I had an opportunity back in the late 80s to go to Lordstown for just 2 months, but I volunteered to do that just to see the difference there. And that was exciting. You know.
When you first became a supervisor, yes, did any of your previous supervisors help you in determining the type of supervisor you were going to be?
Yeah, I had a couple supervisors that assisted me, you know, and that I worked with and give me counseling and advice. But when you're hourly first, you know what you don't want in a supervisor. So I worked really hard at being what I didn't like in supervisors.
What were some of the things that you didn't like in a supervisor? Well, some of the things that you did like.
I didn't like that back in the 70s, management seemed to work the butt off the worker and the problem child they shied away from. So I've always made it my goal to work everybody equally and to step up to the problem child. I think that's what management needed to do. So, and some, don't misunderstand me, that's a big battle. When you take the biggest dog in the pack and bite them, you know, it's a big battle. But only 90% are great workers, only 10% are the problem. And the 10% keeps growing if you don't address the problem. So as a manager, once I went on management, in fact, it was a little too mean. Because I'll be honest, I was too mean. I'm the person who didn't want to do anything. I went out of my way to make sure I got my 8 hours work out of them, too.
Linda Johnson.
Do you have a four-instant story? We were smiling about that. Did you have, you know, you said you thought maybe you were too hard on him, but do you have a specific story?
No.
No?
Not that
I...
No
names,
but you have
to... No names, couldn't you share an incident?
Well, I can share an incident. Me as a manager or me as the hourly
employee? Either way.
Okay. As an hourly person, I had a partner. You know, we usually worked maintenance and crews at two. And he was allowed because of his abusive language. And he was a very strong person, physically built, correct. And every day the boss would come out and give us a job, the supervisor. And my partner would tell me, go get the job. So I would go do the job. One particular day I said, I need help. It was putting up 2-inch pipe. One person cannot put up full lengths of 2-inch pipe by themselves. It's just, you couldn't, it's impossible. So, and it was in the overhead. So I woke him up. He laid right there in the main shop on a bench and slept. And I woke him up and asked him for assistance, and he told me no. So I sit down and waited, trying to apply peer pressure first, and the supervisor come out of the office and ask why I wasn't on the job, and I told him I need help. See? So he tell the hourly guy to get up and help me, and he told him to go away, and he went away. I was dumbfounded. That was the day I got up and walked down to personnel and said I want to be a manager.
That's a great story.
I want to be a manager. And that was the final push to put me over the edge. I mean, there was a lot of benefits to it because I could get my shift. I could pick up my seniority again. Mm-hmm. And then I could tell this guy to go to work. Mm-hmm. And he was on medical the first 3 months I went on management. Honest to God. He went out on medical the day I went on management. But he knew. He knew I wasn't going to let him sleep. You know. I went on my...
Doreen Howard.
I have a couple of topics that you touched on. You talked about safety changes. You said there was a large increase in safety procedures...
Absolutely.
Could you expound on that?
I came down here in 1983, and they issued me one safety lock. Almost every piece of equipment out there has two power sources, electric and hydraulic, or hydraulic and air, or electric and air. There's two power sources to almost everything you touch. They give me one lock. As an hourly person, I could lock out half of it, which to me, I actually told the supervisor to keep the lock because then you know you're not safe. By putting on one lock, you never know if you're safe or not safe. But if you didn't lock it out, I knew I wasn't safe. And I thought that was safer, always being cautious, you know. So you were issued one lock. Today, you're issued three locks, okay? And if it takes more than three to lock down the two others, Robigate had 21 locks on it. We have equipment locks right there, and then you lock up their key with your personal lock, okay? And so the companies went that far to issue, you know, 21 locks for one piece of equipment plus your personal locks. So today you're given three personal locks, and you are reprimanded in one way or another if you don't lock out, see, which is the total opposite. And not only if my hourly don't lock out, I as a manager will be reprimanded if I don't enforce their lockout. See, which is wonderful. Because years ago, they would tell you, oh, you just go in there and get it, you know. And now, even the manager is disciplined if the employee doesn't lock out. So that's a big, that's the total opposite end of the spectrum.
The other question that I want, you started to talk a little bit about Lordstown, that you'd gone down there for a couple months. Mm-hmm. What is some of the differences that you saw between Lordstown and our facility, and, you know, what makes us the capital of quality, you know, compared to the other plants that you were in?
When I went to Lordstown, it was very similar to Fisher Body here and their lines of demarcation versus Chevrolet. Okay, that was, so I was okay with that. They were still pushing numbers, you know, get it out the door, numbers. And I went down for a week just this past year to job shadow, and they were still pushing numbers. You know, get the number out the door. And not that I don't think they're great down there too, but I had to talk to them about lockout while I was down there, their management, because I observed an occasion where they weren't locked out. And he said, we were in a hurry. We need to get these cars out. Cobalts are selling like mad. There's still a difference from state-to-state, facility-to-facility. And we're trying to change that as a company. We're trying to change it. I don't know if you're from Michigan State or you're from Michigan State. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But we are trying to make sure everybody locks out. You know, safety is our overriding priority, and we want everyone to go back home like they come into work. See, but that was the biggest difference, is they're still pushing numbers down there.
Doug Rademacher.
Diane, I want to take you somewhere. I've worked with you for a number of years. I was in the body shop driving a material truck, and I observed that you enjoyed smoking.
Yes.
There was a law passed in the county of Ingham, and can you just talk about that? How did that impact your work life?
Oh, it impacted my work life because I have to leave the facility to smoke, you know. And I choose not to quit smoking. That's a personal choice I've made, that I won't quit smoking for personal reasons. I disagree that I can work in a body shop and have weld fumes all around me from galvanized steel, but I can smoke a cigarette inside the building. I had a personal problem with it. I sympathize with the employees. It's not that easy to just say, I'm not going to go smoke for 8 hours. I'll just skip it. So it did impact my life. It impacted me to the point that when I started getting really wound, even my boss would tell me to go ahead and go out and have a cigarette. But it's the law. I wouldn't violate the law. I would never smoke in the building until they did put in the smoking rooms. Then I could smoke in the smoking room. I liked it a lot more when I could smoke where I chose to smoke. I do. I think, it's the same. We're doing this, but we're going another step farther at Delta, which was my big complaint. See, I smoke. My two other sisters don't smoke. They both weigh 350 pounds apiece, but yet they didn't stop the guy from eating the candy bar on the line. See, now he can eat candy all day long, but I can't smoke my cigarette, you know, because I'm impacting others, but so is his obesity. I'm raising the cost of health care, but so is his obesity. In fact, it'll take me a little longer to die naturally from cancer than from him dropping dead of the heart. So I had some real problems with it.
Well, I just observed you, and I wanted to share that because it's one of our questions about that change, and we really haven't asked a lot of people about that.
But I hate that change.
I knew you enjoyed that, and I started watching you snack, it was just.
But see, at
now,
Delta,
would you, as a manager, did you put pressure on your coworkers if you caught them smoking? Because a lot of people refuse to go outside.
I had to discipline two employees for smoking. Yes, and I put tons of pressure on my peers not to violate the law because we lead by example. And I encouraged the non-smokers to come out with me to get fresh air while I smoked. And it's amazing how many will. You know, it's that little break outside now. But I just can't jeopardize me catching pneumonia in January. Is any healthier for me? But it is healthier for others.
Linda Johnson.
Well, can you smoke out at the Delta plant? Are they going to have facilities for smokers or not?
From what I understand right now, they won't have any facilities for smokers. So I'll have to address that issue when I get there.
You and a lot of other people.
Doug Rademacher. I hate chewing gum. I just hate it. And I think it's nasty. And
peanuts and M&M's. This is Doug Rademacher. It's a different county, so I know General Motors has now said that they've banned smoking within their facilities. Is that correct?
Yeah, GMY. Even in Flint, they're going to non-smoking. They've already cautioned the employees so that they can try to find other means of pacifying whatever it is we're pacifying by smoking.
it's an addiction, but it's being a different county, it's not against the law in that county to smoke.
Yeah, but it's against corporate policy.
It's in corporate, so there'll be, at this point, there's nothing established for Delta, but there'll be outdoors, right?
Yeah.
Like you said, in January in Michigan.
Yeah. I can't see the connection. I mean, I can't. and I never will until they pass a fat tax. I'll never agree with taxing cigarettes either, but that's not for here. You know, I want everybody to weigh on April 15th and pay their $1 a pound for every pound they're overweight for every day of the year. We would never have to collect tax on anything. My two sisters are my biggest harpers on why I smoke, but like I say, number one, my mother lived longer than anyone in my family, and she's deceased before she had her 71st birthday in the hospital. Nobody in my family smoked. You know, they all dropped out of heart attacks, but all of my family fits in the United States category. Over 3/4 of them are overweight, and I mean not just 50 pounds overweight. You know, I have one sister that had to bypass surgery because she's 5 of me. You know, but she don't smoke. Oh, buddy, she's got clear lungs. So I got a bet.
You know, they gonna live longer?
Yeah,
my aunt lived to 87. She smoked since she was 14, and she was a slim lady her whole life.
Because it doesn't kill your heart, it only kills your lungs. The obesity kills your heart. We don't, not that we don't care about obesity, we haven't figured out how to control it. Because Burger King is so convenient, and McDonald's, and you know, all the fast foods, it's terrible. I mean, look at, even here within General Motors, it awes me we haven't changed the vending machines. I used to walk from the body shop up here to the door of personnel because there in their vending machines was cheese and crackers and grapes and apples and oranges. But I worked in the body shop, and you have your choice between pretzels and potato chips and candy bars and candy bars and chewing gum and candy bars and candy bars and candy bars. What would you like to eat for a snack? See, even if we just took the effort and say, here's a vending machine with apples and oranges and grapes and cheese and crackers and something nutritious and healthy, maybe a banana every now and then. See, but we don't. But that's not the reason I'm here. But think about it. We're pushing the wrong.
Everything's
the health issue.
It is part of the culture.
We haven't figured out how to tax junk food. In fact, there's no tax on junk food. You can buy, not even the food tax, not even the sales tax. You can buy all the junk food you want. We won't tax that, okay? Eat it. See, but it's killing us. See, but at least you're killing yourself, not, but then you're leaving your poor children without a parent or your grandchildren without a grandparent.
But, you know, Diane, you were talking about medical culture, you were talking about food. For your employees, what did you guys do for, I mean, I know oftentimes, you know, you work 7 days a week and things like that. So what do they do as far as dinners or holiday parties and things like that, hourly and salary?
We used to have Christmas parties, holiday parties, you know, Easter and that. And that kind of went away. It did, it kind of went away. Salary, we had them off-site, and that went totally away. Hourly, we had a party in here with our guys, and even that died off in most areas. I think the big kick on, we're so diverse now, you know, that a lot of people don't celebrate the holidays we celebrate, and I think most everyone gets away from the holiday traditions where it used to be a big holiday.
Did they do the dinners just because? Do they do the just because there's just because we have to be here, so we might as well be comfortable?
Sometimes, but here now, you have to have permission to have a dinner, you know. And I don't know why we went to that extreme, but we'd have to get a slip signed and everything else for our people to bring any food in to have a dinner. So it was like maybe a retirement party, you will have a dinner. Where it used to be, any reason we could find a party, we'd have a party. I mean, if we're working a Saturday, we'd have a cookout for lunch. Remember those days?
I very well do.
Doreen Howard.
You were at a few different facilities. From your viewpoint, what makes Fisher Body different? What makes our facility different than others?
Because I work here.
Because you work here.
We all make a difference. Honest, we all make a difference. So,
is there any cultural differences as far as the groups of people and the things that they do within the facilities?
I really don't think, personally, because I'm here, I don't know what's happening there. At the same time, we're making the changes here. Mm-hmm. They could be making the changes there. And I will never see them because I'm here. So I only remember what that was, not what it is today. Mm-hmm. However, I have a lot of family still working there, siblings. I came from a GM family. And it hasn't changed a whole lot there. But, you know, we do. We passed this morning. We had a near-miss accident in Wentzville. And so we Lotus notes and email this information around so that I could take it. It was a near-miss on an air motor. So I had to sit my group down this morning and tell them about the near-miss. And that way we'll know to check our equipment for the same thing. So we have to be doing a lot in common at all GM facilities. Now, community-wise, even my housing was different. Up there, I lived in a house, and I knew every neighbor for 3 blocks, and we met every Saturday. If you were available at 1 o'clock, you met at the park. And so when I moved to Lansing, that was different because I chose to do apartment living. And people that live in apartments, they do that because they don't have time for all the other things in life. So that was different, but facility-wise, I think it's very similar in all GM plants. I think the same problems I encounter, you talk to a person in Alabama, they'll encounter the same, because we do, we network, we get together, and you talk to people from other GM facilities at training classes, and you find out it's the same everywhere. We had the same issues growing up, and now we have the same issues as we're getting older. I mean, they're putting us in a workout center now that I feel like I need a walker to walk, you know?
Marilyn Coulter.
Diane, you live in close proximity to the Fisher Body.
Yep, 3/8 of a mile.
And what is it like to live in, you know, close to your work environment from the facility, living that close to the plant?
It has a lot of great benefits. Living close. In fact, to Delta, I'm going to have to drive 6 miles a day. And that's almost kicking me. But you never call in sick, you know. And you never call in and say the snow's too bad to get there. And it helps me with my personal life, living so close, because I only have to get up, you know, an hour early. Some of my employees have an hour and a half drive to work. So I can't imagine how they get up for this morning start. It also keeps a lot of pressure on my personal life, because if my lawn is not mowed, I hear about it. And then my leaves in the front yard, I hear about it. And my old boss, Ollie Blocker from Plant 3, stops by once a week to see if I'm doing okay. I mean, so it has its pros and cons. But gas, I'm saving a fortune. I moved right here on Rosemary, and I love the community. I don't understand all their environmental concerns about the plant, because as close as I was, I didn't smell the plant at night. But they had a lot of environmental concerns in my neighborhood. So I went to their group once, the neighborhood click, to tell them that I didn't have those concerns. Because the factory was here when I bought my house. It really was.
Michael Fleming.
Hi, Diane. You talked about your two sisters.
Yes.
What do they do for a living? And you mentioned GM family. Can you talk about that?
My younger sister is a tinsmith at Truck and Bus in Flint now. But she was also a tinsmith at manufacturing when I was. So she still is 659. My older sister delivers the mail. She's a postal worker. Don't get nervous, but she's a postal worker. And but a GM family. I have a brother who's a millwright. He's at the new Truck and Bus. And I have a brother who's an electrician who, to the best of my knowledge, he's still at Buick. I don't know where at Buick because, you know, he's in the closing down process. But, yeah, we covered four trades. My brother and my two brother-in-laws are just line, you know, they work on the assembly line. They're line workers.
Do you all spend holidays together, maybe?
Absolutely.
Talk about those holidays.
Two of my brothers, they're now ex-committeemen. They were committeemen. And my one brother, Leroy, was a per diem for management, and I was a manager. And we still get together. In 3 weeks, we'll have our family Christmas party. It'll be the 27th one, where we rent rooms up at the Holodome in Grayling. None of us live in Grayling. It's just a trip. And it's close enough we can all go, and the children can go. So there's 63 of us in our immediate family. Eight of us are dependent on General Motors for our main incomes and our family. But we do argue a lot about the politics of General Motors and which plant has it together better and which one has a better rate. You know, I remind him Lansing's always 1 and 2 in quality. Mm-hmm. You know, we were always at the top, see. And I do listen to all of their concerns from the hourly ranks on what's wrong with management. And they have to, no choice, because I'm the most boisterous, to listen to my concerns on what's wrong with the hourly workforce. Team concept, it's a wonderful idea. Okay. I have always had team concept. I got in trouble for the team concept about 10 years ago when all of my electricians in third shift rotated jobs out in underbody. All 8 of them rotated every week. And I thought it was wonderful, and they did. But we were forced to stop that, you know, so that everybody would know which electrician was here. So I found that the team concept works to a degree. Everyone wants their input, but they don't want the responsibility of to be held responsible for the outcome or the decision. And that concerns me right now, because that's as we're going to it as it's your decision, Dave or Doug. Doug, you tell me what you want, I'll stand behind you. You know, and that was our last debate. We met here. A lot of my aunts and uncles are passing away, so we have a funeral every month. 2 weeks ago, my uncle died, and that was one of our discussions at dinner. You know, as I said, we finally give them total team concept here. I'm empowering you to make a decision, you know, that I'll live with, and it's harder than hell to get them to make the decision or to go, even with the guidance, even with the insurance, that I'll support whatever you decide. You just make that. You can't. They want to make the decision without the responsibility. If I can say you told me that, I know you can't. It's the team. Yeah, I empowered your team to do it. Make it.
Right.
See?
Doug Rademacher.
Diane, is that attitude across the board, or is it vary in age groups? Are you finding the younger people willing to take the challenge, or are the older people don't want to? They still want to be directed and have you be the boss, and they'll do what you say, but they don't want to embrace it? Or is it across the board?
Out of 54 people in GA, which I have an older workforce, most of our people have over 25 years out there in maintenance GA, I have seen 3 of them that are willing to step up to the plate and say, hey, I'll go there, and I decided this, and 3. Yeah, no. They can all tell you. You know, they do. They all tell me when I walk through the 54 people, they'll all tell me what they want and what they'd like to see, but they still want me to go do it for them. And here's an example. I have a millwright to this day that wants a welding class that Dallas Daniels from the paint shop took. He wants that welding class. It's offered at LCC. I said, wonderful, because I told him, if you want a class that we don't teach here, let me know, and we'll, you know, try to get you into that class now that we're down for another 4 months. So he said, I want the welding class. I said, well, what's the name of it? Will you go get with Dallas? You know, because Dallas is now located geographically out there at Delta. Go get with him, find out what the name of the class is, you know, and who, you know, how he found out about the class or something. I mean, I don't even know if it's TIG welding, wire welding, Miller welding. He said, no, you do that. I said, well, I can't get you the class. We'll go out there and see Dallas. I said, no, you. We have a shuttle. All you have to do is go get on the shuttle, go see Dallas, find out the name of the class. See? That's all you have to do. Then he said, I don't care enough about the class. Never mind. I said, and there's three other Millerites sitting there. I said, but I told you I'll do whatever it takes. I'll knock down any roadblock if you want this class to make sure you get it. Because he was talking on how great it benefit Dallas. Yeah, but if I got to go find out what the name of it is, I don't want the class. Now, what do you do? What do you do? Now, if I drive out there and I find out the name of the class and get him enrolled next week, I can bet you $1,000 right now the man will go. And he'll be happy to have had the class. But he will not make the effort to catch the shuttle, to go out there, to ask another hourly guy what was the name of that class.
And there is telephone.
Yeah.
There are schedule books. And there are...
So what do you do? But they're so used to, after so long, of telling the boss, this is what I want, this is what I want. And now, here's when I argue with my brothers and sisters, and that was the point I was getting to, because up there they don't have this full team concept yet. It's not working. And that's what they've told me, that it's not working. And I've tried to give them some ideas how they can make it work, you know, because I want to see it work. I really do want to see it work. I said, it's like me. I have a dog. I've had a dog for 11 years, and the dog knows that I have to hurt him bad if he ever urinates in my house. Okay? He did it as a puppy 11 years ago, you know? So he's not done it since. And I said, now after 11 years, it's like me telling the dog, hey, you can do whatever you want in this house. See, it's your house. If you think that dog is going to do it now in the house, he won't, you know. Even though it's okay, I go in the house, I use the facility. See, if I tow my dog tomorrow or locked him in for a week, I think he will die of illness before he would sit in that house. I'm telling you. And that's what basically we've done. We've not allowed you to make a decision for 25 years, and now we've said, make all the decisions. See, and it's like, they want me to do it so that I'll accept the blame? No. I'm finally giving you the endorsement to do it. And I think it will eventually, and that's what I argued with my brothers and sisters, see, because they say, no, management just wants to blame us. I say, no, we as managers, I'm tired of running around for all my hourly. I am. If you want a class, you go find out, see, and then you can have that class. See, and that's, so I've asked them up there in Flint, even though I'm here, you know, to pull their groups together and start helping us. We don't have a trap for anybody, you know. We're not setting traps. We're trying to make it a better corporation. Imagine that.
So
I mean, how could it get any better?
So
Maryland culture.
Basically, what I hear you say, it's the change process and the trust process.
Yeah.
Those are that's also part of that building change.
Right.
All that, we have to change the way we think
about
things.
We have to change the way everybody's thinking and trust.
Mm.
And trust everything, you know. And that's a hard thing to do. Because you grow up, it's us against them. And now it's, and then it was, we'll work together. And now it's, you can even make the decision for me. See, which is great. I mean, it will work. It's, when you think about it in your personal life, you do it, every person does it in their personal life. When they grow up as a child on their own, then they meet someone they fall in love with, then they have to learn to trust them, and then all of a sudden, it doesn't matter if I make the decision or my spouse, it's our decision. See, and that's where we're at. We're combining to make our decisions. And pretty soon it'll work, and we'll live happily ever after. And we're trying to get to that marriage. Which is cool. I mean, it is, because if you'd have asked me the week I hired into General Motors if I ever thought as an hourly person I could have a single thread of input on anything, I would tell you no. In fact, after 5 years, I would have told you no. Because the management walked out, told you what to do, and you did it, or you were sent out.
But with some of this team processes and changes, I know earlier you had talked about like the deep dive processes and stuff like
oh,
that,
yeah.
And how they're able the employees are being able to have this input. So getting there, you're on the road to getting there.
Right, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, I think within 10 years we'll be there. I do. I think everything will come together. At first it has to come together, and that's what we're doing. We're bringing it all together. I think the next generation to hire into GM will just be awed. It's more like a family. It's more like it doesn't matter who makes the decision. Just as a group, decide, make the decision, and follow through with it.
And just going back a little bit, because you said family, and I know you said before you had one of your old supervisors, Ollie, who comes by. So have you had many friendships and stuff built here that have extended outside the facility?
Hundreds. We all do. I mean, I don't know anyone who's ever worked at General Motors that doesn't have friends within General Motors. I mean, there's workers and there's associates and there's friends. But all of us, I haven't met anyone that's never taken a friend out of GM. You know, that's part of it. It's like about high school. You do the same thing. You in school, you have at least one friend from school. And when you hire a GM, yeah. But that's what I mean. I mean, I couldn't even envision 25 years ago a boss coming by who's no longer my boss just to see if everything's going okay or if we need any help. Or and then a guy went to Grand River and, you know, he emailed me that he's doing well. So I sent it out to Body Shop and over to Plant 3 to let him know that, you know, I heard from this guy and he's doing well. And Sears, we established a whole networking outside of work. Yeah, it's like family.
Doug Rademacher.
Diane, is there anything particular that someone had done special for you, whether it be personal or in the workplace, when you may have had a hard time and someone, a coworker stepped up, or a colleague, or supervisor, or regular worker, anybody, anything that ever stands out that somebody was there for you in Lansing?
In Lansing? Just Ollie.
Just Ollie?
Yeah.
Good old
Ollie. I mean, just recently, Ollie. Yeah. But I can't tell you any story where I had anybody step out and beyond other than Ollie, you know, to see how we're doing. And he checks on every one of his old employees, I swear it.
I'd like to ask you another question. You have great attitude and you seem very concerned about doing everything right, but can you talk about one of the funnest days you had at General Motors at Fisher Body Plant? Was there a day that was just a gas or anything that went on that was silly or fun?
We have a lot of fun days. Don't you think I don't have fun here? I wouldn't be here every day if I didn't have fun.
Cheryl McQuaid, could you maybe tell us some of the things that made work fun in here? Were there any pranks pulled?
Let's see. I don't know.
Do you ever remember coming back from being out walking someplace and finding a scooter in your office, maybe?
No. I've heard of a lot of pranks pulled in here. I have, but I didn't participate in them. Yeah, we pulled some pranks and had fun. I'm kind of like drawing blanks. Okay, I'll tell you one in the office, not out on the floor. I know hourly. In the office. Well, I work with another female supervisor, Annie. I'm on days, Annie's on third. Okay, and there's a particular gentleman working in between us. So I wanted to name him. But one day, rumor come to it, second shift had 5 male maintenance employees, and for some reason on their meeting they started discussing women logs. I gotta tell you this. So what happened, they talked to me in the morning and I talked to Annie, you know, at night when I come in. They said, our meeting was over you know, you girls write too long a logs. See, you know, and women do tend to write a lot more detail than men. So I said, oh, yeah. And I said, yeah. So then I talked to Annie, and this was a newer boss. So we confronted the second shift boss together. I made a special trip in here, you know, so we could put him on speaker, and we let all the guys that was in his meeting, you know, listen and stuff like that, listen to what he said, squirming out of the fact that he was gossiping about our logs. So, and this is, you got to see the humor in it. So we all laugh because even the guys working for him know that he was on speaker. He's the only one that didn't know. So we let him stew for a little while because he called them into his office one at a time to let them know that somebody had snitched him out to us. So, but if we all know what's going on. Okay. So we had laughs over that for a week because then the next week we didn't write anything but good day, bad day. So this joke goes on, and this is how these little jokes impact you. When that person left here to go to Grand River 4 years later, and we called and told him before the end of the shift that the day was over. 4 years later, he called us up there and said, you really taught me a valuable lesson that day. And it was just a joke. So he said, I've never, ever discussed a woman's log since. So, and here's a more recent one similar to that. We were having a Delta orientation. This was salary pranks are different than hourly pranks. We're having a Delta orientation, and my boss, he, who would be the maintenance superintendent, he made a comment in his stand-up about one of our tech supports, a rather vertically challenged, he's short. And he said, oh, stand up tech support. Well, Dave, come on, stand up. Oh, you are standing up, you know, being so short. So we all laughed. You know, it was in the Oldsmobile room. We all laughed and thought nothing of it. So that was the day of the GA picnic. We had a picnic so you could get to know everybody. And the next thing, George Weller went up to him and said, you know, I received some concerns that you are discriminating against short people. See, now this is, we have a new superintendent who's from Truck and Bus in Flint down here. He's only been here a short while, see. And he said, I don't know how well this is going to go over at salary personnel, but I'm sure you're going to have a meeting because, you know, this is the assistant plant manager that had heard about this short comment. So then Dave, as our superintendent, he said to us group leaders, ooh, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be fired over this one or how far this is going to go. He said, you know, I said it in a spirited way. I was just having fun. I say, well, it's not fun if you happen to be that short guy. It may be fun for the rest. But to make a long story short, the whole picnic, McNitt was worried. And they come up to him right at the end of the picnic and said, how did it feel? See, we were just joking. Nobody voiced any concerns. They actually talked George into doing that, which awed me, because, and that impresses me, that he can play a prank too. And I think that's, because you got to have fun with work. You know that. You have to have fun. You know. Not too much, because we've had too much sometimes.
I want to take a short pause here.
Diane, we really appreciate you coming and sharing all your memories with us. And I just want to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Any questions, just call.